All right, since Canada's part of the Commonwealth, we're running on England time, which means promptly to start, rather than the American habit of let's give it a few more minutes to see who shows
up. At the University of Toronto, it's always 10 after.
Is that right?
It's the Toronto, if anyone...
And you say you're not the 51st state.
Yes.
So, welcome, everybody. I'm Jonathan Citrin, a longtime collaborator of Professor Dieberts, and so pleased to have a chance to introduce him. One of Ron's themes is that you are being watched, and I should let you know, not just generally, but right now, you are being watched. We are streaming, are we not? Are we streaming or just recording?
Recording, that's right.
Even worse, I mean, even more, it means then that whatever is said here will be preserved for the ages on the internet. So be aware when question time comes and such that that is the case. And there's also this helpful hashtag, hashtag black code, if you'd like to be tweeting during the event. So I first met Ron, I think, 13 years ago.
Really?
Wow. It's so sad.
Yeah.
Just the passage of time.
Pretty
sort of a
we'll
deep philosophical moment here, yes. But yeah, I think we met 13
right?
years
okay.
ago when a student of mine and I had been placing international long-distance calls from Griswold Hall using a modem. Remember modems? To log on to a series of ISPs in China as if we were in a hotel in Beijing and needed to get online and just using our modem for a local call, and then asking for one website after another to see what was and wasn't blocked in China. What was and wasn't blocked in China was known perhaps to about a billion people, but not widely published or ascertained. And it turns out Ron was working on exactly the same sets of questions using a significantly cheaper method than placing long-distance international calls. We had to revert to Ron's method after the dean got the bill over here. So it was fortunate that we, in realizing we were working on the same stuff, immediately determined that we should team up. And that alone is such a great example of what makes Ron the standout person in this field of endeavor, and that he really wants to uncover the truth about things. He wants to get stuff done, and he's happy to work with such a wide range of people in order to make that happen. And over the course of the 10 to 13 years now, Ron is just exactly the key to understanding so many of the different communities that are in this space, the public interest and human rights groups, the government organizations, the hackers. Ron has connections with each of them, and in that sense has just proven an invaluable hub to understanding what's going on. He's talking about his book, Black Code, which I understand is compelling, .. That's apparently what I think, and I do. This is such a great summary of the kinds of work he's been doing, and I just can't help, I'm sure you'll talk about it in the course of your talk, but to have emanating from the Citizen Lab, which Ron founded and heads, not only such observations as the fact that Skype TOM, the Chinese language branded version of Skype, was routinely radioing back the Skype instant messages to a central server, not only did Ron discover that,
NART.
But then his team, including NART, whom you'll hear about, Ron and NART, then went into the server that was the mothership to which all of these Skype messages were being BCC'd, and then was able to see what other stuff was being captured there. So not only realizing that his own version of Skype was compromised, the test version, but to see everything else was quite extraordinary and, dare I say, quite gutsy. And to discover other networks of malware, not just built-in defects like the one in Skype, which my recollection is when the New York Times caught wind of this, crediting the Citizen Lab, and wrote it all up, Skype's response was, we take security very seriously. Like, that's just what they said. And I believe to this day, the behavior is still in Skype TOM.
Well, now we know it's a lot worse.
So you'll be hearing about that, that now, in fact, it's a lot worse. But this is what made Ron the go-to person, for example, for the Dalai Lama, who instead of calling like the Geek Squad when his laptop wasn't working, had the presence of mind to get in touch with Ron and his team, who promptly determined, again, not only had the Dalai Lama's laptop been compromised and pwned, in an era before we just assumed that everything is pwned, but was able to work backwards to find the embassies around the world, the news organizations, everything else that had been pwned by the same network of malware, and then facing it, I hope we'll hear about this, the question of, do you tell them? Should you like ring them up, be like, hi, I'm from the University of Toronto and I'm here to help, and you've been pwned? It's a very interesting call to have, and possibly a reality show derivative if the Citizen Lab needs funding. It seems at least
we're
as good.
We're working on that.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So I should turn it over to Ron, but in doing so, share just what a privilege it's been to work with him as part of something called the OpenNet Initiative between now the Berkman Center here at Harvard and the Citizen Lab, to have learned what I've learned from him, to see him on the road, sometimes scheduled, sometimes not, as we pursue very much the same sorts of thing. And just, you're a gentleman and a wonderful person, and we are so pleased to host you today to tell us about the battle for cyberspace.
Can we just end it there? And be perfect. I think I'm going to cry.
Over to you.
Yeah. Oh, well, great. And the book glows in the dark, by the way.
And the book glows in the dark.
Thank you for that introduction. Can everybody hear me fine? It's really flattering to have Jay-Z here. One of my favorite people, especially to listen to. I mean, I was remarking earlier that I think he's got to be the best lecturer ever. And, you know, you should be selling DVDs of it or something. And to everybody else for coming and the Berkman Center for having me. The title of my talk is actually, it's not about the book. I'm kind of taking off from the book. It's meant to be about the Snowden revelations. I think the title's After Snowden or After Prism. And you can't turn on a news report or pick up a newspaper these days without another of these revelations coming out. And even prior to it, you know, cybersecurity issues regularly dominated the headlines, with like Fortune 500 companies being breached and possible attacks on critical infrastructure. And obviously it's important to all of us because our lives are now enmeshed with these technologies. Our kids, our work, our livelihoods, everything we do depends on it. And the Citizen Lab, which I direct, that Jay-Z mentioned, has had as its mission since its founding to lift the lid on cyberspace and apply an interdisciplinary approach that combines technical interrogation, field research, and social and legal policy analysis to find out what's going on beneath the surface of the internet. I like to say, think X-Files meets academia without the aliens, maybe. Is that a good description?
Not yet.
Exactly. That's next episode. We have a core staff in Toronto, but we work with networks of individuals, including the Berkman Center, all over the world. And we've been a kind of digital early warning system, I would say. And what we've observed over the last 13 years or so has really been, frankly, troubling. I believe cyberspace, the internet, whatever you want to call this, is changing fast and not necessarily for the better. There's a battle going on over the future of this domain as policymakers and others wrestle with the governance and security challenges. And I think the NSA Snowden revelations have actually amplified these pressures. So my lecture today is going to be divided into three parts. In the first part, I'm going to briefly summarize the Snowden revelations so far and try to put them in a bit of a broader context, both historically and today. And then in part two, I want to discuss some likely implications or consequences. And I guess if there's a thesis to my presentation, it's this. I think the consequences in the short term are going to be mostly bad. Bad for the internet, bad for human rights. And then the last part, I want to just ask the question, well, what do we do now? What is the response going to be among those who care for an open internet and human rights worldwide? So first of all, the Snowden revelations. Interestingly, my book, which is very much on topic, there's lots about signals intelligence in my book, Came out May 21st, the very day that Snowden left for Hawaii. And, you know, some people write a book and then their biggest fear is that there'll be some revelation that's going to prove some important empirical detail wrong. But for me, it was like, oh my God, a chorus opened up from the heavens and supporting material flooding out with each week. So it's been kind of wonderful that way. But of course, it's not much of what has been released has been surprising for most of us who have a modicum of understanding of the world of intelligence. But a lot of is out there now for the general public that I think the general public was not aware of. So what have we found so far? I'll just go through very quickly. I mean, first off the bat, on June 5th was the Verizon revelation that the NSA had been collecting wholesale the call records of domestic U.S. communications in cooperation with Verizon. And I think this is the first time many people heard about metadata in the general public, that is. And it turns out that metadata is actually very useful for intelligence purposes, more so than content, because it's structured data that can be easily compared and analyzed. And it also is why President Obama could say coyly, "No one is listening in on your phone calls under this program," as well as what he said. Next up, the day after, was PRISM. And there we found out about the collusion, complicity of the major internet service providers, telecommunications companies, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and so on. First, the companies, of course, deny, and we later find out that they are denying because they're under national security orders, letters, gag orders that prevent them from divulging that they're actually complicit. After that, I think the most significant one was the revelations about the GCHQ and the fact that a lot of the undersea cables that run the backbone of the infrastructure of cyberspace were being tapped at landing points in the United Kingdom. This is an enormous volume of data, as it turns out, and one of the most fascinating parts of the revelations in my mind. And then the most significant, I think, were the codename Bull Run and Edgehill, where we found out that the NSA had been systematically weakening encryption standards, putting in place corrupt encryption backdoors, and essentially a covert shaping of standard-setting forums in some of the international bodies where these things are implemented. And that was also where, by the way, we had the cameo appearance of Canada's own NSA CSEC. So in Canada, there is now a debate being generated about oversight of CSEC that I'm very much involved in. And then just a couple of weeks ago, Operation Socialist, which I think was significant because there it was revealed that the GCHQ had been essentially engaged in intervening in Belgium's core MX routers, the hardware used by the mobile phone system in that country. So this is, you know, an attack on an ally, and I think that's certainly going to cause some blowback. And there's more to come. Apparently, Snowden's documents, only about 20% of them have been released, a fraction. Now, for me and my colleagues, as I say, a lot of these revelations are not new, and I think it's important to understand that there's a history of signals intelligence among the Atlantic Alliance countries that goes back at least to World War I when GCHQ was founded. In World War II, you have the US-UK agreement was signed, which formalized the so-called Five Eyes. And even some of the programs are decades old. One of the interesting things I like to point out, many people were outraged when they found out, well, the NSA has been eavesdropping on the United Nations. Well, if you go back and you look at the very conference in San Francisco where the United Nations was set up, the entire conference communications were intercepted under arrangement that is very PRISM-like between Western Union, which was the largest telegraph carrier at the time. They were still under wartime censorship powers, and they turned over all telegraphic communications in and out of the country around that conference to the predecessor of the NSA. And during the Cold War, all of the great powers built an arsenal of sea, land, air, and space-based signals and imagery surveillance systems that are really quite fantastic. Like this one, I love. It was designed to collect stray microwave transmissions that bounce off the surface of the moon and come back to Earth, and they were collected that way. And of course, the satellite systems, I think, are really quite interesting. We haven't heard much about them with the Snowden revelations, but it's a favorite area of mine. Signals intelligence collection systems in space, optical reconnaissance systems that can see through clouds and in night and all weather and so on, down to the level of centimeters. And, of course, there are quite a few details in the public domain prior to the Snowden revelations. If you look at the historians of intelligence, like James Bamford and Richard Aldrich in the UK, wrote a big, fat volume about GCHQ, where most of the details of all of this are clearly laid out. So to some degree, when you hear people say there is nothing new in these revelations or crack about being shocked to find gambling in the establishment, are to some degree correct. But there are evolutionary changes that have occurred in a significant watershed that fundamentally transformed the nature of what we're talking about here, and that was 9/11. And that is what is the what's new part to all of this. Several things in the wake of those attacks happened that we know more about now. First of all, the focus turns inward. All of that I described in the previous couple of slides about Cold War surveillance, it was oriented around a kind of spy versus spy paradigm. They were focused mostly on each other and mostly on sensitive diplomatic communications or ballistic missile tests. But after 9/11, especially, but really starting after the end of the Cold War, you have a shift in intelligence away from state-based actors turning inwards to all of society because of the changing nature of the threat. You also see around 9/11, a culture shift, a kind of all bets are off attitude, which is based primarily on, you know, recognition of the horrific nature of these attacks and the threat that was faced at the time, which was very much seen as existential, but also a, quote, failure to connect the dots. So there's this urgent desire to overcome the barriers that prevented these agencies from connecting the dots. And you also had a culture shift at the time that includes what we know now is almost an outright irreverence towards and sometimes even a dismissal of the rule of law, bend the rules, edges of envelope type of thinking. And then, of course, you have legal changes, the Patriot Act and other laws passed in countries like United States, United Kingdom, Canada, that dramatically empower law enforcement and intelligence agencies while watering down oversight mechanisms. At the same time, you have new technological platforms and a shift in the defense industrial base. Total information awareness, I think, being the most infamous of them. The idea there, if you go back and look at it, is really quite prescient, right? Is the idea is we're going to vacuum up everything, you know, credit card transactions, phone calls, you know, emails, everything into a massive database that we can analyze and index and archive. But the association of the guy behind it, Poindexter, and his association with the Iran-Contra affair, I think really freaked a lot of people out, as did the logo, by the way, which was poorly chosen. What is this? You know, some creepy thing. And it was killed in Congress. However, we now know that it wasn't actually killed at all. It just atomized into a number of smaller programs that went deep black and black budget. And so throughout the 2000s, you had this enormous mushrooming of what I call the cybersecurity industrial complex to service this enormous black budget sector. This is from a series in the Washington Post done by Dana Priest called Top Secret America. I really urge you to take a look at it. It does a nice job of slicing up all of the different companies and sectors around this black budget, tens of billions of dollars developing surveillance, big data analytics, and even offensive computer network attack capabilities. And to process it all, the NSA has had to build an enormous new data complex in Utah. I just flew over this complex last week, and it really is quite something to look out the window and see this massive construction going on. They call it NSA's cloud. And I think that's a pretty apt description. If you think about the volume of data that has to be digested and processed and just the cooling equipment that has to be set up in this facility is is quite something. So this sea change in the intelligence posture of the United States and its allies is happening at the same time as two fundamental shifts that are occurring that are essential to understand for different reasons. And the first relates to the ecosystem of communications itself and to our own digital habits. Now, people talk about communications revolutions all the time. You know, the internet is obviously thought of as being in line with previous revolutions in communications like the printing press and telegraph and so on. In my mind, one of the biggest has happened just within the last 5 years or so, and that's the rise of social networking, cloud computing, and mobile, those three together. Of course, you know, I don't need to trot out statistics to this crowd about all of that. All three are integrated, too. We now use our mobile devices to access Gmail and Google Docs and update our Twitter and Facebook accounts, all with the same device. Apple just announced that it had crossed the 50 billion apps download threshold. That's about seven for each and every person on the planet, each of which hives off information about our digital habits when we click on the terms of service and sends it to someone to be shared with someone else. And let's not forget about the so-called Internet of Things, tens of billions of internet-connected devices and potential sensors of our actions, thoughts, social relations, and movements. Now, taken together, when you add all of that up and think about how quickly this has all come about, I believe this constitutes one of the biggest transformations in communications in history, purely in terms of the amount of private information we now entrust to third parties. And what's even more significant is how we're going about securing it. At the very same time that we're in the midst of turning our digital lives inside out, the world's most powerful surveillance machinery is turning inwards on all of us. A surveillance machine whose overarching intention is to shield itself from public scrutiny, to barely acknowledge its own existence, to operate in a cloak of secrecy. I think that's profound, and I think we've not yet had the proper conversation in Western society, in global society, about the proper balance between surveillance, privacy, whatever you want to call it. It's profound. The other big change that's happening simultaneously is one that's actually rarely mentioned, but I think is equally significant, and that is the who of cyberspace is changing fast. And the who of cyberspace is as important as the what is cyberspace, all of the technology. There's a major demographic shift happening as the center of gravity moves from basically the north and west of the planet, where all of this technology was invented, to the south and the east. And if you look at statistics now, well, the West, North America, Europe may have built all of this. It now makes up just about a third of internet users. Asia comprises 45% of the world's internet population, which is the most by region, but it ranks only six in terms of penetration rates at 28%, meaning there's this enormous population yet to be connected. Most of them are young. It's significant that of the 6 billion or so mobile devices on the planet today, 4 billion are in the developing world. In 2001, just 8 out of 100 people in the developing world had a mobile phone subscription. Now nearly 80 out of 100 do. And some of the fastest growth is occurring from the world's weakest states, fragile, failed states. In many of these countries, religion plays a very important role in governance. Many of them are autocratic or authoritarian regimes. So in the wake of the Snowden revelations, what will be considered legitimate practice there? What that we do here will influence or legitimize what goes on there. Remember, these countries and their populations are coming online at a much different time than the early adopters. After the PRISM revelations and with the model of the NSA in mind, at a time when cybersecurity is at the top of the international agenda, and when products and services of unparalleled surveillance and computer network exploitation powers are being offered commercially. Which brings us to the consequences. Well, I have a lot of discussions with people about this. Obviously, some people think that there are going to be major inroads into oversight and that this is going to reinvigorate investigative journalism. I think there's some evidence of that. In my own country now, people are asking questions about our own NSA that they never would have asked before. And I think that's positive. But at the same time, I think, you know, there are obviously issues around news cycles being short and people's attention spans being distracted. I find it remarkable that General Alexander still has his job, actually. And the reaction here tends to be kind of muted. I would think there would be a, you know, an urgent call for something like the Church Committee, and it just hasn't happened. So public reaction may quickly get exhausted and then the scandal will fade. More likely, in my opinion, are a series of consequences that are bad in the long run for the Internet, for democracy, and human rights. And it's to these that I now turn. There are four of them. The first one, I think you have to start out by dispelling a myth right off the bat about the relationship between territoriality and cyberspace. The physical geography of cyberspace matters very much. Now, most of us approach the Internet without thinking much about anything beyond the computer screen in front of us, right? We send an email and it magically appears on someone else's desktop. And we approach it kind of the way William Gibson first defined it, as a kind of consensual hallucination. But it's important to understand that while our Internet experiences may seem to be kind of a virtual mirage, the infrastructure in which they are embedded involves a complex material, logistical, and regulatory political system that spans multiple jurisdictions from the local to the national to the international. While the text, the image, the video, and all of that may seem within our immediate grasp, they are not. Data that we handle, that we assume is in our possession, are in fact transported to us in an instant over cables and through radio waves from arrays of servers, many of which are far from us in another political jurisdiction than the one in which we live. And those political jurisdictions matter a lot. Take cloud computing, for example. Data that used to be stored in our desktops, in our filing cabinets, have evaporated into the clouds. But where exactly are the clouds? Well, it turns out that the answer is that a fairly disproportionate number of them are floating across the territory of the United States of America. And that's a huge home field advantage. Actually, I think Michael Hayden, the former NSA director, put it best when he said, "We built it here, and it was quintessentially American. Much of the traffic goes through American servers where the government, quote, takes a picture of it for intelligence purposes." Very frank. Now, what country, when reading that, will want to continue to route its traffic through the United States or depend on U.S.-based infrastructure? Now, I think it's important to understand that nationalization processes around the Internet, around cyberspace, have been going on for quite some time. In fact, as part of the aim of the Open Net Initiative has been to document that process. And over time, we've seen a growing number of countries put in place Internet controls. 15 years ago, when we started, there were maybe a handful of countries, China, Saudi Arabia. Now there are more than 40 of them, right? We've seen many imposed borders, firewalls, sensors to exert greater state control. We've essentially seen a normalization of Internet censorship practices. And the technical means of controls are complemented by a thicket of regulations applied to cyberspace. New stifling laws are being enacted. Governments are arresting bloggers, tweeters, etc., criminalizing access to web content, or even in the case of Pakistan, to entire platforms. Today, Pakistan just announced they're going to ban Skype for 3 months, requiring the private sector to police the Internet. And if you go country by country, this process has been well underway for some time. For example, the India's 2011 Intermediaries Act, I urge everyone to look at it and read it in terms of some of the things it requires ISPs to screen out. Content that is grossly harmful, harassing, blasphemous, defamatory, obscene, pornographic, pedophilic, whatever threatens the unity, integrity, defense, security, or sovereignty of India, or is insulting to any other nation. Am I right, Malakiva?
I take full responsibility.
Now, in light of the system the NSA has set up, it will be hard to argue that such laws in cases like this are unjustified or excessive. Some other examples, I think, more importantly than China's and Russia's, the countries most people say, are countries like Brazil, thought of as swing states. This is from an article that Bill Woodcock of Packet Clearinghouse wrote, I think, just a couple days ago in Al Jazeera, talking about Brazil's response to the NSA revelations. Of course, the president of Brazil was quite explicit at the United Nations. I think she spent more than half of her speech talking about the NSA. And domestically, Brazil has talked about building a system that will bypass the United States entirely. Whether that's futile or not, it doesn't matter. What's important is that this process is underway. And as Bill points out, in fact, it's been underway for some time in Brazil. Brazil has, according to this graph, I think the second most internet exchange points among countries worldwide. After the Snowden revelations, we will see more countries try to localize cyberspace, build internet exchange points in their countries, but many of them will use them as local points of control. And the impact on U.S. business is going to be substantial. Already people are talking about losses on the order of $200 billion and so on. Alongside the domestic process, there will be an international dynamic to this. There'll be greater policy coordination among those countries regionally and internationally at the United Nations, at the International Telecommunications Union, to lend normative support for their domestic policies around censorship and surveillance. Now, many people, I think, in the room will remember the last ITU summit in Dubai, and the story there was about how the U.S. Allied countries, the Western countries, won a temporary victory forestalling decisions that would have been taken there that would have been threatening to internet freedom. I think that victory is very short-lived. In fact, I think Hillary Clinton's internet freedom agenda has had the diplomatic wind sucked right out of its sails now. And I'm about to head off in a week or so to Bali, Indonesia, for the Internet Governance Forum. Already you can see the tenor of the debate starting there about taking back control of the internet at local levels. Even more significant than international dynamics, I believe, are what's going on regionally, which tends to get overlooked. I think we should focus on forums like ASEAN, the Gulf Cooperation Council, or the African Union, which just put forward a document on cybersecurity that addresses the NSA revelations, or this fun-looking group, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. This group has a regional anti-terror structure known by its Mission Impossible-sounding acronym, RATS, Regional Anti-Terror Structure. Can you believe it? You can't make that up. And what they've done is, over the years, they've been engaged in coordinating policing exercises, and they're quite explicit about this, designed to counter Arab Spring-like movements from erupting in their countries. And there's a whole political economy dimension to what they're doing. One of the projects of the Citizen Lab were focusing on the Sochi Olympics. Huawei just won the bid for tender for the contract for the surveillance of the entire city. And that becomes essentially a brochure that will be marketed to other countries that want to use those same technologies to implement surveillance by design. Third, I think, alongside domestic controls, international and regional coordination, there'll be many countries, and we're already seeing it, who will want their own NSA, essentially. But they'll follow a different playbook. For example, many governments have already, and for a long time, have seen the underworld of cybercrime as something they can exploit for strategic purposes, for espionage, for warfare. And the best example of this is the report that Jonathan mentioned off the top, our GhostNet report. And as he said, it began in the offices of the Dalai Lama, not on his laptop, but that sounds better, actually. And the The concern there among the Office of the Dalai Lama and Tibetan organizations, they thought they were being spied on, and lo and behold, they were. And after many months of forensic investigation, we found out that not only is the Dalai Lama's office and the Tibetans being spied on, but we were able to see through a kind of back door the attacker's whole command and control system. And we could see all the other victims nicely laid out. And it was, you know, a blockbuster. Among the victims were hundreds of government ministries, embassies, prime minister's offices, on and on, Foreign Affairs Ministry of Iran, and so on. Now, the interesting thing about this report to me is that the attackers were able to compromise computers in these locations by means of basic social engineering techniques, typically by sending emails designed to have the recipient open them, and then they contain malicious payloads. This is actually the Ground Zero email. This was received by the Office of the Dalai Lama, and it's a, if you look at it, you know, what's notable about it, it looks legit, right? The from line looks legit. Subject header, it's not like an advertisement for Viagra or something that you delete, right? It looks like something, if you were a Tibetan and politically minded, you'd probably open the attachment. But the attachment contains malware. The malware in this case was something called GhostRat, where the name GhostNet comes from. The capabilities are profound. It allowed the attackers to silently remove files from computers under their control, take screenshots, record keystrokes, even turn on the audio and video captured devices, effectively turning the computers of victims into silent wiretaps. Now, GhostRat can be downloaded for free today. It's open source. It's been translated into multiple languages to make it more user-friendly. And it is a constant menace to dozens of human rights organizations around the world. In the studies that we do in the Citizen Lab, in cooperation with human rights organizations, GhostRat is the primary malware used as the tool of choice by attackers by a factor of probably 10 to 1. And that report came out in 2009. So this is not a billion-dollar program. It's cheap. It's easy to use. It's free, in fact. It's readily deployable. It's not rocket science. It's not even MIT science, right?
This is affiliate
fees, don't you? Yes. It's more like basement science, but it's very effective. So in my opinion, with tools like this, we've entered the age of do-it-yourself cyber espionage. And what will surely be an ever-expanding garden of homegrown, localized NSAs. What might we expect from them? Well, I think we have some prior cases that we can go on based on our research and that of others. Take the case of Iran and Syria. So it used to be fashionable, not that long ago, to kind of mock authoritarian regimes when it comes to the internet. They can never withstand the force of information. But today, that's changed entirely. They're getting very savvy about how to manipulate the information space to their advantage. And I think the NSA revelations will give added impetus to that. If you look, for example, at what happened during the Green Movement in 2009, so you had this movement emerge that was very much based on social media. Remember, people dubbed it a Twitter revolution. And it was very powerful. But the Iranian regime didn't just stand still. They took countermeasures, more offensive actions. The internet was slowed down in many cities, and there were periods when it wasn't accessible at all. It essentially ground to a halt. SMS messaging and mobile phone connections were suspended or jammed. Through evidence that emerged afterwards, it became apparent that the Iranian authorities were able to get the largest cell phone carrier in the country, Nokia Siemens, to turn over information to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. You could call that Iran's own PRISM program, if you will. And cyber organizers found themselves being targeted and arrested. There was also the pro-regime group, the Iranian Cyber Army, that began hacking and defacing websites and infiltrating social networking platforms with malware of the type that I described. Families of protesters based outside of the country found their activities monitored, their websites watched, and the Green Movement essentially dissipated. We had a report that we just released recently in the Citizen Lab called After the Green Movement that I think describes this dynamic. The very same thing is going on in Syria right now. The Syrian government is employing essentially the tradecraft of cybercrime to infiltrate the computers and the networks of opposition groups, in some cases to target them, arrest them, and kill them. So cases like these are the playbooks for asymmetrical warfare for autocratic regimes, who will no doubt justify their actions as merely local variations of cyber commands, NSA, or active defense. Now, for many of us, this is kind of all daunting and horrifying, but for some, it's a business opportunity. As cybersecurity needs have grown, a massive industrial complex has mushroomed to service and profit from them. And their wares are sold at obscure international trade shows like this one, which they claim are restricted to defense, law enforcement, and intelligence agencies. That may be true, and it sounds nice, but some of the governments who are represented there are among the world's most nasty regimes. And these products and services are now showing up at a worldwide level and for a variety of purposes. And I believe the NSA revelations will send a bonanza through this market as governments reach for the latest cybersecurity snake oil. Now, over the years, if those of you who follow the Citizen Lab know that we've been tracking products and services developed by Western manufacturers that show up providing censorship, surveillance, whatever, in some of the world's most nasty regimes. Citizen Lab contributed to reports that unearthed the use of smart filter in Iran in 2005. That was done with the Open Net Initiative. Fortinet in Burma in 2006. WebSense in Yemen, Tunisia, and the United Arab Emirates. All companies headquartered in Silicon Valley. We've also published reports about a Canadian company, NetSweeper, who sells products and services to ISPs in Yemen, Qatar. In fact, the entire Pakistani Great Firewall right now is run by a Canadian company based out of Guelph, Ontario. We've done three reports on Bluecoat, which is really interesting. I mean, this is a company that provides network monitoring capabilities that actually are quite benign. So it's a dual-use technology. The same technologies in the wrong hands could be used to monitor dissidents and crack people's emails and so on. In our first report, we found that Bluecoat products were found in Burma and Syria. And this brought about some significant pressures, even calls for a congressional inquiry into Bluecoat. Afterwards, we did a wide area scan of the internet looking for the signatures of Bluecoat systems. This was really interesting. We found a lot of positives and then eliminated all the instances that are on private networks just to show examples of Bluecoat installations that are on government or national networks, and we came up with this very long list. And as I said, while the type of technology does have benign uses, deep packet inspection and so on, can we be so sure that it will be used in benign ways in places like Iran, Syria, Indonesia, Venezuela, Kuwait, and so on? And there were four instances where it's a violation of U.S. sanctions at the present time. Probably the most troubling area that we've been involved in, I would say, is around the more offensive kind of dark market technologies, the most well-known of which is Gamma's FinSpy. We've released several reports on this product. It's an interesting story, actually, how it all emerged. So we found out through interactions with journalists primarily, in this case a Bloomberg reporter, that dissidents in places like Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, they were being arrested and tortured, and during their interrogations, this fellow, for example, he was presented with transcripts of his chat messages that were encrypted. And afterwards he said, well, how is that possible? How do they get at my Skype messages and so on? And so the Bloomberg journalists contacted us, and we analyzed his computer. It turned out that among the he as well as many others were infected with Gamma's FinSpy product. When you reverse engineer the malware, you'd see a little signature evidence there as kind of a smoking gun, FinSpy, and there are other elements of it. And then we did, in this case as well, a wide area scan of the internet, which was fantastic. This took more than 2 months and involved sending more than 12 billion packets of information across the internet. And we found evidence of the command and control servers of the FinSpy product in a number of troubling places, like Mexico, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, among others. And now civil society groups in Mexico and Pakistan are launching legal cases. And our research has really only picked at the surface of a growing field here. Products that provide advanced deep packet inspection, social media, social network mapping, cell phone tracking, computer network exploitation, essentially advanced spyware, are being developed by U.S., Canadian, and European firms and marketed worldwide, mostly to regimes who want to use it to focus on isolating, identifying, and disabling opposition groups. And that market really knows no boundaries. We're starting to see Chinese, Indian, Israeli, other firms stepping into the same marketplace. After the Snowden revelations, will any of these countries be willing to accept our self-serving moralizing as any kind of meaningful constraint? If they ever did, I doubt it very much. If the NSA can pursue these capabilities, why can't we, they'll certainly say. So where is this all adding up? To me, it looks very bleak. I think, first of all, we're going to see a magnification of what's already happening around nationalization of controls, but also a growing arms race in cyberspace that could have some very dangerous, unpredictable consequences. Excuse me. I think this is bad for NGOs, bad for opposition groups, bad for human rights, very bad for digital humanitarian projects, which I think are being undertaken without full understanding of the risks that they face in a lot of these contexts, one of the areas that we're really interested in working on. But most importantly, I think this portends the end of an open internet. People have been talking about balkanization of the internet for some time. We are going to see that process really accelerate. So what do we do about all of this? I think it's pretty daunting, but here I think the revelations actually offer an opportunity for us to kind of step back and ask a set of questions. I remember at the beginning of my presentation, I said that we've gone through this wholesale change in how we communicate that's transformative, historically transformative, at the very same time that we're giving to these super secretive agencies enormous powers. And I think we need to have a conversation about the right balance. But going further, I think we need to ask some fundamental questions, beginning with, when it comes to cybersecurity, security for whom? Security for what? I've been, for a long time, arguing and making the case that whenever something is securitized, there is an instinctual tendency to default to a certain approach. And I'm a political scientist, an international relations guy. I think of it in terms of realism. And that approach has some characteristics that we see popping up all over the place in terms of responses to cybersecurity. Hierarchy, secrecy, closure, building borders to the outside world. And of course, this fuels self-fulfilling prophecies and dynamics of mutual suspicion and so on. And there's a kind of deference to military and intelligence agencies taking the lead. Now, as compelling as this tradition may be, it really fits awkwardly in a world that knows no boundaries, where threats can be inside, outside, wherever. And that which requires securing, namely cyberspace, is a globally networked commons of information. Ultimately, this paradigm is fundamentally incompatible with a free and open internet. And we have to make that case strongly. You can't have your cake and eat it too. Now, another approach comes from the opposite end of the spectrum, and I think it should be equally discredited, in my opinion. I can understand there are many who are outraged right now, now that machinations have been exposed, and want to do away with it all. There's this kind of instinct that if we could just eliminate governments entirely, we'd be better off. You can see a bit of that in the prompting that people in the engineering community, I think Bruce Schneier is among them, saying engineers need to take the internet back. And as compelling as that may be viscerally, I think this also is short-sighted. Because we have to remember that without organized government, we wouldn't be able to protect the very rights that we care about, right? We'd end up quickly in a kind of Hobbesian world. So those two ends of the spectrum, I think, are problematic. Now, this is interesting here. This is an infographic that ICANN put together prior to the Snowden revelations, and it's called Who Runs the Internet? And it's this vision of the kind of multi-stakeholder approach. I think we have to kind of look at this and ask ourselves, what of any of this now can be salvaged? And if so, how do we go about doing it? Now, one of the things I've been doing is trying to advocate for a deeper understanding of the philosophical roots of liberal security and this model which underlies it, what I call distributed security. And I think we need to reach back and understand those roots, shore them up, and support this vision. And this model as a whole actually has roots that go back to ancient Greece, the Renaissance, and the founding of the United States of America. It can provide an overarching narrative as a contrast to both the realist and anarchist models. And it can tie together different activities that are going on among disparate but like-minded communities. In other words, we need to wrap all of this in a narrative and remind ourselves about some basic principles that stem from that tradition, like mixture, division, restraint, oversight. This is nothing new, but we need to somehow salvage that. And I think, obviously, this is a long-term mission, and there are many components to it. And I think I'm not going to go through everything here and just lay out some of the areas where I think, practically speaking, there are opportunities to work on things. Right down to the level of code, for example. I think thinking things through from the bottom up gives new impetus to the philosophy and politics around open source, for example. Among the liberal democratic core of countries, it's obvious that we need to reinforce and put in place better oversight mechanisms. I think we need to give more power to agencies like privacy commissioners and independent auditors. We need more formal agencies empowered to watch the watchers. One of the things that I've been adamant about, and it comes from the experiences of the Citizen Lab, is an understanding that we have to deal with malicious forces out there. And, you know, I'm in a city where you don't have to remind people about this. There are people who want to wreak violence and can cause massive harm. We do need law enforcement. We do need intelligence agencies, but never without proper oversight. And that's what we've lost sight of in the liberal democratic core. Warrantless surveillance is incompatible with liberal democracy. Most of cyberspace is owned and operated by the private sector. We hear that all the time. And that's a good thing. We need to encourage that. But we also need to encourage not only corporate self-governance, and initiatives like the Global Network Initiative, I think, need to be extended and buttressed and so on. But we need to also subject private companies to the same kind of independent verification mechanisms and auditing and so on. All of that needs to be beefed up. And I actually believe that universities have a special role to play because we are custodians of the original internet. And I think it's from the university that a lot of the original characteristics of the internet emerged. And so we need to build more interdisciplinary centers like the Berkman Center, like the Citizen Lab, that have as their mission to lift the lid on all of this using mixed methods approaches and act as an independent, credible voice based on empirical research that will call out things that are going on that shouldn't be going on. I like to think about arms control in this space. I come from an arms control background, and arms control is largely dismissed in this area. Information is not a weapon. There's also an association with some Russian proposals that I think discredited the idea. But I think it requires revisiting now. It's worth reconsidering how we think about controlling weapons, controlling behavior associated with those weapons in a distributed environment like cyberspace. All of this together is a job for the liberal democratic core of countries. It's something that requires those countries to begin by cleaning up their messes at home and then focusing outwards in a way that rescues some authenticity. And we need to start thinking holistically about it. I'm very pessimistic in the short run, but I think in the long run, it's really up to us. Cyberspace is ours, it's what we make of it, and we need to take it back collectively. So I'm going to end there, and thank you very much. and hope to generate some discussion or questions.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if you could speak to like how deep the Pwnage hole might go. You know, we've got people like Bruce Schneier and Jake Applebaum talking about how you know, strong cryptography is still useful, and I think it's a testament to that that some people are still walking free. But it's also true that like SSL has been compromised, and you know, it's hard to know how much has been compromised, and it feels like that creates a breach of trust that makes any dialogue about, you know, like kind of arms, you know, race with cyber weapons, yeah, difficult. It's hard to even have that discussion when you're not sure like how deep the Pwnage hole goes.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a very important topic. I have great respect for Bruce Schneier. I think some of the commentary he's made has been excellent lately. I think that encryption is critical. I think we need to better understand and communicate to people how to depend on it, especially people who are at risk. Frankly, at the Citizen Lab, we work in a very security-sensitive environment. We've gone through a kind of a fundamental change, actually, cleaning our own house up in terms of just being a bit lazy about it ourselves. And that may seem surprising because we do take great precautions. However, I think there are a couple of things about that that concern me. One is this can't be solved by technology. There are problems here that go deeper than technology. Technology is important, but it's not the ultimate solution to this. It has to come from policy and law and understanding proper oversight mechanisms, because otherwise we will have results basically along the lines of what you're saying, that we can't fully trust what's going on. The other thing, you know, with this call about engineers need to take back the internet, there's a problem with that. It mythologizes a time that I don't think ever existed. Most of the engineers who built the internet, including a lot of the people in this vicinity, were dependent on U.S. government and military contracts. And so there was never a time, in my opinion, when there was this mythical space where engineers were doing everything for benign reasons. In fact, I think there was, from my perspective, I always found it curious for many years prior to the Snowden revelations, among many in the engineering community, they would characterize cooperation with law enforcement and intelligence agencies as kind of working with the good guys. Right? They're the bad guys, and usually in their mind it was like the Russian hackers, spammers who were doing malicious things on the internet. And if the FBI comes calling, well, they're the good guys and we know them and let's work together. So a lot of policing of the internet took place in informal collusions between engineers, networks of engineers, law enforcement, and even intelligence agencies and private companies, botnet takedowns and so on. That still has to continue, but it has to be subject to much more scrutiny and oversight than presently happens. I think we need to lift the lid and peel back the layers of these informal policing activities that go on all the time on the internet, most of it for good reason, but none of it really subject to any kind of independent oversight. And that doesn't even have to be formal. I think the next Internet Engineering Task Force meeting, which is scheduled for November in Vancouver, will be really interesting, because there are a lot of people who have been involved in that forum who were on the payroll of the intelligence agencies and covertly shaping the standards. It'll be apparent who they were based on maybe their non-attendance now, right? So I'm actually going to be in Vancouver at that time. I might try to drop in there and talk to some people. But forums like that we have to reinvigorate as well. It's a really interesting conversation to have, I think.
One of the more appalling revelations of the Snowden disclosures was that the NSA was transferring large amounts of raw, unfiltered metadata to that nasty regime in Israel. How do we protect the information and surveillance of private citizens in one country if it's given to intelligence agencies of a foreign government?
So again, that's an excellent question, and we need to think more deeply about the international politics of cyberspace and my point about territoriality and jurisdictions mattering. I can say that confidently as a worrying Canadian, your neighbor to the north. I was on a panel, in fact, it's not in the book, in another op-ed I describe an anecdote where I was on a panel with Michael Hayden and Kenneth Minahan, two former NSA directors. And I said at one point that it concerned me as a Canadian, the only non-American on the panel, that you two are talking about commanding cyberspace for the rest of us, as if that's a good thing. And Minahan replied, said to me in front of this audience, you shouldn't describe yourself as Canadian, you're North American. And actually, that is as disturbing as that is for a Canadian to hear. When it comes to the infrastructure of telecommunications, he's absolutely right. About 90% of our communications traffic flows through the United States by nature of the fact, if you look on that graph that Bill Woodcock put up, there are really only two internet exchange points that function like internet exchange points in Canada, one in Toronto, one in Vancouver. And that means that most of our emails, even if there's a great experiment done by colleagues of mine at the University of Toronto, a project called IX Maps. If you go to ixmaps.ca, they have a great video that demonstrates if you send an email from the University of Toronto to the Hockey Hall of Fame, which is just down the street, it's very likely that it will transit through Chicago and one of the internet exchange points there and hence to an NSA eavesdropping facility and then back to Canada. So, you know, that's one story, one bilateral relationship among hundreds worldwide. Now, I'm concerned that in the short term, as I said, governments are going to use the excuse of protecting themselves from NSA surveillance to implement essentially national controls. So we have to be worried about that as well, that in the rush to protect themselves, they'll essentially put in place borders around cyberspace, and we can't let that happen. Ultimately, the only way to answer this question is by progressively adding some kind of meaningful oversight, independent oversight. Now, given that we're talking about international politics, that can't be some formalized agency. It has to come from civil society, in my opinion, and that gets us right to the importance of independent research from universities. I think universities have to step up now and say we're going to act as independent monitors and oversight mechanisms to ensure through whatever means, investigative research, technical forensics, and so on, in collaboration worldwide, that we watch the watchers and ensure that that type of thing is not going on. It's very difficult to control for that. It's not easy, I would say. So.
Hi. So I was recently on a trip I was in Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, China, and I was talking with students there about what did they know about how to jump the firewall and so on. And they said, oh yeah, we all know that, we learn it as soon as we get here. And I said, well, do you ever do it? And they said, well, almost never. And I said, why not? And they said, well, because why do we need Facebook? We have Sina Weibo. Why do we need YouTube? We have Youku. Why do we need Twitter? We have WeChat, et cetera, et cetera. And it really made me, rethink the dynamic of what's going on in terms of thinking about, part of what's happening here is each nation state partly wants to set up its own net so that it can create a domestic industry of web services that are so, popular and lucrative. And I'm only bringing that up to kind of maybe add an additional layer of difficulty or complexity to the problem, which is that nation states may now use the NSA revelations to justify the extension of creating domestic networks, even if in large part it may or may not necessarily be that the security and control concerns are really the primary driving force. So the political economy of creating domestic internet industry also militates against the type of the goal that you've set out there.
Absolutely, and it's a dynamic that was underway before these revelations, as evidenced by research of the Open Net Initiative and others. And I think now it's going to accelerate for the very reasons that you outline. I think that an interesting angle to it that we need to understand is that with these revelations, I think, comes a recognition that let me put it this way. When I was in Europe, I was speaking to a number of European officials who were slowly waking up. This is prior to the Snowden revelations that, oh, if we use Gmail and Google Docs, even if the servers are physically located in Belgium or whatever, they're still subject to U.S. law. The Patriot Act extends to wherever the services are being offered. And so there'll be a recognition that, well, if we have homegrown products and services and so on, they're subject to our law. And also in a lot of countries to our informal pressures. So, you know, the structures of oversight that you have in this country are all very formalized. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, obviously, informally behind closed doors and all of that, but is nowhere near compares to what happens in a place, you know, like Pakistan or maybe even Indonesia, right, where there is a lot of informal politics and corruption and so on. And I think that process is going to be magnified. Ryan, I can't believe you sat through the entire presentation. I thought you'd be standing. Everyone's standing at the Berkman Center.
Well, hi. Thank you very much for your nice talk. Well, I am a political scientist also. I'm so glad you are here because, you know, I'm using your paper for my course, International Political Economy in Digital Age. Okay. So I know that, you know, you are a few political scientists who are focusing on, you know, the cyberspace. So after, you know, the hearing your talk on the kind of consequences of this kind of debate, I mean, even though you mentioned that kind of multi-stake model to solve this kind of problem, I really doubt about the, you know, future of this, you know, the matter, mm-hmm. because particularly territory is, you know, it's a matter of the state action. Mm-hmm. So I can see the kind of conflict between the ICANN and ITU nowadays. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the kind of conflict between the U.S. model and the maybe the China.
We can't call it the U.S. model anymore. The U.S. model turned out to be something.
Maybe, but, you know, U.S. dominated kind of model,
okay.
ICANN, and also the model initiated by these, you know, developing countries, including yeah. China and India. So how do you think about those conflicts nowadays?
Well, there's so many processes underway internationally that have an impact on this. You know, obviously ICANN, International Telecommunications Union, very important. I mentioned the Internet Governance Forum, which we'll be attending in force from the Citizen Lab in middle of October. I think that event is going to be really interesting in terms of the dynamics around conversations having to do with this. But there are also a wide variety of other forms that are rarely looked at by internet technology people. Most, you know, security forms like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization or ASEAN, the African Union and so on, Organization of American States. All of these regional forums are now discussing cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is huge. It's the top of the agenda for just about every country now in the world. And I think, especially in the wake of these revelations, there is going to be, you know, an impetus to, you know, devote resources to it, create government agencies. You see countries creating cyber commands and so on. And countries want, you know, the game of international politics is to develop normative support, to lend legitimacy for what you want to do domestically, support your trade and finance and so on. And I think the momentum around that is going to be difficult to prevent from taking root, especially among a lot of swing countries. And then layered beneath that, I think, is the political economy part of it. So the whole export of infrastructure that has surveillance built in by design is going to be very attractive to a lot of policymakers in places like Africa, Latin America. Which is why we're looking at the Sochi Olympics, I think, is a really interesting case, an event where you're taking the city and essentially rebuilding it with an entire infrastructure designed around total surveillance. afterwards there'll be brochures about this. It'll be marketed to, you know, other countries engaging in development. So that this looks really bleak to me. And, of course, when you look at that and contrast it with the U.S. model, which we used to associate with Internet freedom, right, Hillary Clinton's speech and the Freedom Online Coalition, my sense is among that group of countries and the diplomats that have that file, they're demoralized right now and they really don't know what to say because they've been shown to be, not they themselves, but their countries to be hypocritical, right? They're mouthing these, you know, Internet freedom, what you're doing is bad. Actually, we've been doing it all along. So that has no credibility anymore. And I sense that there's just, you know, I've been at meetings, people are preparing for IGF, the next ITU plenipotentiary meeting. I get a sense that there's a crisis. They really don't know what to say. And so there's a kind of, it's as if the wind has been sucked right out.
Much, Ron. Two thoughts, and some of them, they're both half-baked, so maybe together we get the full cake. So one of them is, it feels like, I mean, there's the two arguments. We're going to talk about a political solution to kind of rein surveillance in a matter, and the other is some kind of technological solution. It feels like the political solution would be to ask the NSA to collect less data in some manner. And their counter-argument is going to be that you're asking us to disarm while the rest of the world continues to arm themselves. So I guess the question there is that under what scenarios would that be a winnable argument? Is mm-hmm. it really asking them to unilaterally withdraw on that? Mm-hmm. And the other question is, I guess, related to both politics and international flow of data and technology, is we hear a little bit less about the commercial infrastructure of the Internet, which parallels the civil rights infrastructure of the Internet in mm-hmm. order to continue to engage with business online.
Yeah.
These businesses, it doesn't have to be perfect, mind you, but there needs to be good enough security that they feel you know, confidence enough to transact money and credit cards and those kinds mm-hmm. of things over lines.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually don't think a viable solution is to go to the NSA and rein in, say, the volume of data they collect or even how they go about collecting it. It's part of an argument that I hear where people say we need to get rid of surveillance, and I think that's impossible now. We've gone so far down this path where we secrete so much data just on a daily basis that is emitted and shared with third parties somewhere that we can never turn the clock back on that, and frankly, I don't think it's even desirable to do so because we now depend on it for many useful things. So the critical entry point, in my opinion, is around oversight. So we have to be able to have assurance that whatever is being collected with someone watching who's independent of that effort to ensure that it's not being abused or misused for some, you know, purpose other than that for which it's intended. And that's why when people talk about the privacy surveillance debate, I say, you know, the privacy issue is actually, it's the wrong focus. The focus should be on the potential for abuse of unchecked power. That's what we're really concerned about. If you start talking about privacy as the important thing to focus on, well, you're already losing a battle because of what we give away voluntarily anyway. You know, here I am sitting throughout this entire lecture and my mobile phone in my pocket is emitting a pulse every few seconds as a beacon to the Wi-Fi router, and I'm not even using it. And it gives away the make and model of the phone. My name is there, the operating system, and the same for all of you. And that's all just going on. So we can't close the curtain on all of that, nor should we. Instead, we need to focus on proper oversight mechanisms.
You had mentioned the difficulty getting people riled up about this and excited about it, and I was just wondering if you had any ideas about how we as students might be able to go about doing that. I'm also interested in what you feel the potential might be for repression of perhaps social movements in this country or political upheavals in this country. And also in terms of mobilizing the university to help, the difficulties there related to the fact that much of, you know, university funding comes from governments and also from large private interests, which seem to be emerging with governments as well. So,
well, again, it's a very not easy to answer, and there's no simple solution. But there's an interesting angle here that I think might be exploited in a Machiavellian kind of way, and that's, I think it also picks up on something Rob mentioned, where once and if and once, I should say, revelations emerge that show the NSA manipulated financial markets, we'll see a huge blowback from the private sector, I believe. And already I think, you know, I haven't had a chance to have really deep conversations with friends at companies like Google and Microsoft and so on, who maybe now, after what has come to light, they feel a little sheepish about, you know, our prior conversations that we had and maybe what they knew. But even those companies, I think, might begin to realize when the losses hit their pocketbooks, you know, in terms of the reactions internationally, they might be willing to start funding these sorts of things. I see kind of a hint of that happening now. It begins with the foundations. You know, the big foundations that support research are now interested in this area. They're starting to canvass opinions about, you know, what should be the right focus. I think there could be private sector funding for this emerging. The key is to, I think, string out a narrative about the role of and responsibility of the university as a custodian of knowledge, and that in order to be a proper custodian, we need to overcome disciplinary boundaries, right? And it's still very difficult. You know, I'm in a school of global affairs, an interdisciplinary school, and the Citizen Lab is interdisciplinary from the ground up. In fact, there couldn't be a better model for that. But it's difficult to actually create something like that and sustain it. People coming out of programs like that with degrees still have difficulty landing jobs because they don't fit the usual boxes. That has to change, and I think that's something that students could, you know, press for. And, you know, Berkman Center is a great model for that reason, right? Like, it's something that I think should be trumpeted loudly and duplicated all over the world, right? Like, we need more of this sort of thing to undertake that kind of independent research. There's one at the back there, too.
Could you talk a little bit more about the oversight that you're suggesting? Could you talk about, would it have teeth, and how would it differ from Congress and the current oversight?
Yeah, well, that's a tough question, obviously, because, you know, I had a debate about the legality of all of this with somebody who's actually a proponent, advocate of the NSA, and he was saying, you know, all of this was authorized legally through the three branches of government and so on. You know, I might quibble with that because I believe that Congress was misled. Clapper lied to Congress, in my opinion. So there's that. And, you know, I think there's a culture shift that happened. A lot of the mechanisms of oversight somehow were co-opted and, you know, made complicit with what eventually materialized. And so somehow that culture shift has to change. I think one thing that I picked up upon that might be useful for Americans, in Canada we have at the national level and also provincially very strong privacy commissioners that actually have teeth. Our privacy commissioner went after Google and fined them, and they had to change some of their practices, and same with Twitter and so on, because of domestic Canadian law. She essentially internationalized Canadian privacy regulations. I think we need more of those type of agencies, and the key will be to advocate for it. And one way where it might gain some traction is by making the point that as citizens, we entrust so much personal data to third parties. We need independent auditors and commissioners like that who are going to ensure that companies properly secure it, don't share it without our permission, and so on. And I think that might be something that can have some traction when people begin to fully realize all the information that they're giving away, which is now I think we're beginning to educate people about that. But, you know, bottom line is I don't really have a good answer for how the whole thing was approved. And, you know, the 9/11 was momentous, right? I mean, certainly I can remember that. Many people were viscerally, you know, it impacted them viscerally, and it was kind of like all bets are off. And I can distinctly remember having conversations with, you know, the three-letter agency type people who said, you know what, this is a new game. It's a world without boundaries, and we're going to take our gloves off. And it's not just surveillance, the targeted killings, the drone strikes. If you look at that whole area, it's really quite profound.
I'm curious, as a follow-up on that, to what extent do you think that the oversight you're seeking could be resolved through simple transparency? So in other words, anytime you have national security issues, you're going to have transparency problems, but is there some level of optimal transparency that would largely deliver the types of oversight you're seeking and also perhaps be a better indication of kind of overarching societal norms in relationship to that, right?
Yeah, most definitely. I think, first of all, we have to appreciate that intelligence and defense, law enforcement, to some degree, requires secrecy. And there needs to be a discussion of what is the appropriate level of secrecy, depth of secrecy, and what is not going to jeopardize means and sources and so on. It was interesting that recently the New York Times had a story that said among the intelligence communities that believe that their own revelations about eavesdropping on that Al-Qaeda conference call did more damage than any of the Snowden revelations, right? So we need to have transparency reports, I think, are an interesting mechanism. That's why I support them in among the private sector. And it's interesting that, you know, there'll be that continued pressure, I hope, on companies that you need to disclose this, not only in the United States, but worldwide. And this should somehow become a norm, right, that we essentially pressure them into doing that. So vehicles like Electronic Frontier Foundation's scorecard are very important for that reason. You essentially shame companies into doing this. I think I'm on BlackBerry's hit list in Canada because I've been this relentless questioner of what are they doing in India, United Arab Emirates, and so on, and they really detest me. But I use the pedestal of the university just to ask questions. Well, what arrangement have you made? How is it possible that you could make that arrangement and say that your system is entirely secure? So we need to have this relentless kind of pressure, not just on governments, but on the private sector as well.
Thank you for speaking today. I have one question about, I would like to hear your thoughts on quantum technology. And,
oh, good Lord.
its effect on perhaps cybersecurity. Canada is one of the pioneering countries in that field. And theoretically, quantum computing can break the factor, prime factor encryption, also quantum internet can theoretically provide completely secure communication. So do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, there's a cartoon that I tweeted about maybe 2 weeks ago that I think is really, it speaks directly to this point. I think it's an old cartoon, and it shows an image of these two, you know, computer geeks who are talking about creating this super powerful, unbreakable encryption and how they think, like, no one's going to be able to do it. And then the next panel of the cartoon is one of them being beaten with a rubber hose and divulging the information. So, again, it gets back to technology as a solution. I don't think whatever the magic is behind it, ultimately, you know, human beings are human beings and politics is politics. We need to have political solutions for this and legal solutions for this as much as technological solutions.
Yeah, I think we have time for one more question.
Uh-oh. Okay. It's the home opener of the Boston Bruins. We have to all go back and watch them.
It seems sometimes that there's a complete lack of understanding of the technical issues on the part of the legislators and the people tasked with oversight. How do you get past that if the people doing the oversight and making laws don't even understand the possible outcomes of their decisions.
Don't elect them. Well, and also have, you know, other means of oversight than just the lawmakers. I think, you know, this is why we need researchers. We need the ACLU. We need EFF. We need these organizations that are going to call out people when they say things that don't make sense. And we need more of that. It needs to be distributed, right, rather than focused in one place. Is that, oh, there are a few people that, you know, I'm happy if they want just a couple more. You said a minute, maybe? Okay.
Sorry, just you were talking about relentless questioning a minute ago, and you're talking about different channels of oversight now, and I work for the Nieman Journalism Lab, and I just have a two-part question. Do you think there's anyone left in the media that can do that in journalism, anyone who's doing it, and is there anyone who's doing it well that you read with any frequency? Because, as we all know, it's not an area of great competence.
Yeah. So, actually, in the preface to my book, I point out that, you know, there is this concern that you're raising that people have, which I think is valid. But at the same time, Citizen Lab research has regularly been profiled in New York Times, Washington Post, Bloomberg News. Every major media organization has spotlighted our research, just to give one example. And, of course, they've been the outlets for a lot of the revelations that we've heard from The Guardian, Washington Post, and so on. So to me, the problem is not so much that there's something wrong with the establishment, you know, the journalistic establishment. It has to do with why aren't people listening or caring about it? That's more of a concern to me, and I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I think also investigative journalism, obviously, you know, I see what's happening in editorial desks, producers. It's being cut back systematically. In Canada, it's atrocious, really. Like in our television, there is no really independent investigative journalism going on up there. And it's really a problem. So we need to rectify that somehow. I'll never get invited back on CBC now. Maybe this should be the last one for the sake of the...
I do want to say that, encouragingly, there is meaningful political opposition in the United States to what is going on, and there is meaningful political mobilization that is going on at the moment. And I'm actually the Boston organizer for the StopWatching.us okay. demonstrations that are happening at the end of the month in D.C. and elsewhere.
Yeah. Very important. Yeah.
I think it is realistic to say that people are angry and that people are mobilizing. My concern, and perhaps you can speak to this, is that we are mobilizing against a political culture that is very defensive of the surveillance establishment and its new practices, and that the surveillance agencies in themselves have conducted surveillance on any of the individuals who are capable of affecting the budget or the practices of the surveillance agencies. So in the context of that level of institutional corruption, what would you say are the ways that we can reach the situation where the surveillance community is paying attention to people who are in your position and to institutions such as the Berkman Center and to the technologists who really know what they are doing with respect to the internet?
Well, I think it's going to take people to advocate and educate and also create forums and spaces for dialogue with that very community. Right? It can't be something, you know, there is an important role and space should be carved out for the type of protest that you're organizing. I firmly believe that. But at the same time, there has to be, you know, quieter channels for dialogue with the very people that you're protesting against, maybe not by you, but by other people who can try to understand better what their constraints and concerns are and you know, hope to begin a process at a number of levels. And we've done that at the University of Toronto. I think similar things have gone on here at Harvard, and I think it needs to continue. I really appreciate everybody coming out, and I'm here for a few minutes, although that Boston Bruins game is really tempting. I'm a big Bruins fan, so welcome to join me at the... Rob, what's the bar? Cambridge Commons. The game's on there, I think. So if anyone
wants to... books in the back for sale. So thank you.
Thank you very much.